I came, I wrote dissent specifically around Israel and Palestine. When Benjamin Netanyahu came to Canada, it wasn't only at Concordia University that people organized to demonstrate his presence. It was everywhere that he was invited to go by the Asper Foundation. That was Winnipeg and Toronto, I believe. There were demonstrations organized. There were news press conferences organized. There were all kinds of teach-ins and things like that in all of these places, organized by a whole variety of people, by Palestinians, by Jews, by Christians, by atheists, basically by anybody who wanted to call attention to this man's really brutal and violent legacy, which is still playing itself out in the occupied territories to this day. This is somebody I think people really need to remember who has made the statement quite overtly and has used his position of power to advocate the idea that there will never be a Palestinian state west of the Jordan. Basically saying, absolutely saying, that Palestinians can go to Jordan. I mean, that's as close to a call for ethnic cleansing or transfer or whatever you want to call it as you can get without actually saying it. And it's a sentiment which not only condemns Palestinians but also Israelis to basically a never-ending future of pain and suffering and violence. And I think the people who organized around against Netanyahu's presence felt the need to call attention to that. And when I was here on September 9th, it was, as Stefan mentioned, it was my first day at Concordia. It was also my first day in Montreal. And I was really glad to join in demonstration on campus. I was really surprised to get here and find the doors locked to students and community members who wanted to take part in the demonstration, basically to be able to defend this as a venue, my university and Dell's university, as a venue for somebody who I think if he was tried by Nuremberg standards would definitely be called a war criminal. I have really no doubt about that. I remember standing, once we got into the university, standing on the escalators with protesters, none of whom I knew because I didn't know anyone in the city, and watching people filter into the auditorium where Netanyahu was going to be speaking, and just watching them with incredible distress, because I really wanted to know why they felt they needed to be protected from us, from me, by a row of riot police and helmets and masks and batons ready to go. Oh, and dogs, too. And I just really wondered, sincerely, if they honestly believed that we were all a group of terrorists or violent thugs, or if there was no recognition that we could have a meaningful position and that our passion was based on some sense of justice and moral outrage. And I also really wonder whether the people who are going in to listen to Netanyahu, whether they even really know what exactly it is they're supporting. I like to think that they don't. And I can't be too hard on people, I suppose, who are oblivious to the realities of the occupation of Palestine, because I do relate. I grew up with the same mythologies. And they do, as Sabine said, go to the very core of how the Jewish population thinks of itself and thinks of its position and thinks of Israel. It really goes to the core of identity. I grew up with this idea that Israel was created as a land without a people, for a people without a land. And it's very normal to hear that in growing up in Jewish schools and, you know, going to Israel when you're a teenager. But what we don't sometimes realize, and what I didn't realize until maybe not that long ago, is what an atrocious idea it is to the people whose land that is, to Palestinians. It writes Palestinian history entirely out of the books. It writes Palestinians out of the books. It denies their existence. I mean, what does it mean to deny a people's existence? What can it mean to them? And also, what does it mean to those who do it? It gives us a sense of some moral imperative, some right to ignore the moral imperative to support their struggle for liberation, because we deny that they even exist and that they have any right to that land at all. I also remember growing up with the idea that Palestinians were basically just a fantasy, and that they were created, the idea of Palestinians were created by the Arab world in order to be used to push to destroy Israel, to push the Jews into the sea, that kind of thing, and to validate their struggle. And Israel, according to this vision, is really this sort of David to the Arab Goliath that can do no wrong. And it really did take me a lot of thinking and a lot of reading and a lot of listening in order to change some of my impressions about that. Also, while I was standing on those escalators, I can say that... some of my anger at Netanyahu having been even invited to the university was really intensified by the fact that I had just come back from Palestine. I'd spent 2.5 weeks with the International Solidarity Movement, which many of you probably know a little about. It's a movement, a Palestinian-led movement, which uses nonviolent direct action tactics to oppose the occupation and to try and mitigate some of its violence. My time there, however, was spent just sort of getting to know some of the realities of the occupation, just getting to experience them firsthand. And I think anyone who spent some time there in the last 3 years probably can attest to this. But there are certain things that you simply can't learn by reading or by watching documentaries about what it's like to be in the occupied territories right now, what occupation actually feels like. And I carried all of those things with me into that demonstration, and I'm sure that anybody who's been there, and certainly anybody who's a Palestinian and either has experienced these things themselves or has family or friends that are currently there undergoing this kind of terror, carried that with them into that protest. I've written a lot and I've spoken quite a bit about some of my experiences, and I don't have time to go into in Palestine, and I don't have time to go into any of those things in detail right now. But something that I can tell you is that I was completely stunned by how violent and cruel the IDF is towards Palestinian civilians on a completely regular basis. And I can also tell you that life is hell in Palestine. And that's not only because men, women, and children are killed on a pretty regular basis, but also because regular life is really robbed from all of those who are left behind. I wonder sometimes how exactly to explain to people who are free to move and to breathe and to live what the claustrophobia of the occupied territories is like right now. What it's like for people's homes, for their towns, for their villages and their cities to be turned into enlarged prison camps, which are surrounded by roadblocks and by checkpoints, and they're manned by the armed guards of the IDF. And how to explain to someone the daily humiliations people have to suffer just to be able to go to the next town or village to see friends or family when they are stuck at checkpoints, standing in line for hours and hours and days and sometimes weeks in the hot sun. Well, IDF soldiers treat them like nothing, treat them like they're not even human, push people around, you know, laugh at fathers in front of their children, take their identification away from them. I saw an old man pushed to the ground. Soldiers shoot into crowds of indiscriminately. You know, I don't know how to explain that to people. And I also don't know how to explain what state terror actually looks like what what it feels like to be under the constant threat of violence, to know that even if you're allowed to leave your house because the IDF lifts curfew for a few hours, that you could be caught on the street. They could change their mind, and you could be caught on the street trying to go and buy groceries or something, or food for your family, and be shot if you happen to run into a tank. And I also don't know how to explain to people just the glimpse that I got of the sense of futility and despair that a parent must feel when they can't feed their children any longer or send them to school or really promise them any kind of a future. I met one woman whose daughter had been shot by a random bullet that had come through their window. It had ricocheted off the wall, and she had been shot in her, she'd been hit while lying in bed, and she was left permanently paralyzed. And her mother, there was nothing her mother could have done to protect her. And these are just realities of the occupation. They're the daily realities, and they're left out of those occasional articles that we get to see on like page 20 of our local newspapers that read, you know, blank number of Palestinians killed. IDF claims they're Islamic Jihad, and if there just happened to have been five other children that are killed, or five children in the vicinity or something that happened to have been killed. We don't know anything about these people. We don't know their names. We don't know who they were. We rarely know their ages. And it's so incredibly different than when Israeli civilians are killed and we find out who they are. We hear the interviews with their parents or their children who are in mourning, and we identify with them because, you know, they're blown up in pizza parlors or in dance clubs or something that, you know, we can, as North Americans, we can often really relate to. And it's good. I mean, we should know about civilian deaths, and they should become real to us, and we should empathize. But the reality is that so many more Palestinians have been killed, and we have so much less identification with them. Why? Because they don't die in pizza parlors and dance clubs, because life in Palestine has been so crushed that there aren't pizza parlors or dance clubs or really, you know, much of anything left. There isn't even, you know, basic civil infrastructure, so we can't identify with them. And we need to be able to empathize with the Palestinian people as well. I guess one really powerful experience for me, and I hope I'm not running too much over time, was being in a refugee camp called Nor Sham. I think that's how you pronounce it, refugee camp outside of Tel Karam. And just for anybody who's never been in a refugee camp in Palestine or hasn't seen pictures, I mean, they're these incredibly claustrophobic places. People are really, you know, piled up on top of one another, and there's really just no room to breathe. I just remember standing, looking down at the only like playground in the entire place. It was the only open space in this really, you know, densely populated, claustrophobic place, and it was the only like open space where children could play or anything. But they couldn't play there anymore because the IDF had been using it as for target practice, and all the swings and the slides and everything were shot up, and there were bullets lying in the grass, and there was Hebrew graffiti and Stars of David's scrawled all over the walls, which is something that you find out that certain members of the IDF like to leave behind. They like to do this so that, as far as I can tell, so that Palestinians know that even this little piece of hell that they're that they have right now, even this isn't really theirs for keeps. Even the IDF even wants to stake a claim on that. And I also remember meeting people in the refugee camp, So many people have been shot by indiscriminate shooting in that refugee camp. It's in a valley, and the hills all around it, the Israelis would come and just randomly shoot at the camp. And there are bullet holes in every building and every house, and windows are busted from, you know, bullets coming through. And we met so many people whose loved ones had been killed just by random shootings in a sort of way, as well as by the regular incursions. And I remember talking to one woman who invited us into her home for tea, and she had, you know, nothing in her house except these 8 children and a picture on the wall surrounded by these brightly colored plastic flowers of her husband, who had been killed while walking on his way to work by an Israeli tank that just happened to be there because he accidentally ran into it. And she'd ended her story of this kind of terror of her life with the question, why? And it's something that gets tacked on a lot at the end of statements and sentiments and expressions of terror, of these sort of terrible lives, of stories that people tell us of these terrible lives, and they so often would end these statements with why. And it's an incredible thing when that sort of terror gets transformed into a question for you, because I think once a question is asked, even if it's rhetorical, in a sense, you're asked to answer that question. And I think that what that did to me anyways is it called on me to respond. It asked me to be like a complete moral human being, an adult human being, responsible for my own actions and also responsible for my own inaction. I think that that's really important. I think that turning these things into a question, why this suffering? Why are people's tax dollars used to support this sort of military violence? Why would I remain passive in front of all of this while my name is being used? Well, these things are being done in my name. As a moral human being, I haven't got the right not to act. And that's what that question meant to me. And just to bring it to the ISM, on the ISM website, there's a quote, and I think that sort of ties all of those sorts of ideas up. That's from Albert Einstein, and it is that the world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it. Anyways, I'll just skip ahead. Jaggi's going to talk, I think, about the ISM and about some of the things that are going on with the ISM right now. But I'll just say that I'm sure a lot of you have heard about some of the recent targetings of International Solidarity Movement activists in Palestine. And I have to say that I imagine that I can understand exactly what some of the people who have been shot and Rachel Corey, who was run over by an IDF bulldozer and killed, exactly what they were thinking that motivated them to do the things that they did. Rachel was trying to defend the home of a friend who was a doctor whose home in Rafah was about to be demolished. Another man, Tom Herndl, was shot while trying to get some children out of the street who were being shot at by Israeli snipers. And I can just imagine that it was the same question, the same why, that motivated them to do exactly what they were doing. Why wouldn't you? What right would you have not to try and protect the home of a friend? What right would you have not to try and help children out of the line of fire? Anyways, there was a lot more that I was going to say, but I think I'm going on and on. So basically, why did we protest Netanyahu? Because the reality is that the vision that this man represents is one that denies the possibility of peace, which denies the possibility of justice, which is committed to a system of apartheid backed by state terror. And We protest and we dissent and we refuse because at a certain point, this is what we need to do to remain human. I guess I just want to talk really briefly about what's happened since September 9th. I think that there's been a real misrepresentation of the events and also of the anti-occupation activists at Concordia and everywhere. I believe that some of the population of the Jewish community honestly is afraid. I think that they're afraid not because of what anti-occupation activists do, say, or actually stand for, but because of the kind of misrepresentations of our beliefs and of our actions that you find in the mainstream media. Something that specifically stands out to me, I guess, is that I know that the CSU and other organizations have been attacked lately, especially at Concordia, have been attacked quite a bit lately. And one of the things that's been said is that the CSU is, what are you guys, anti-Israel, anti-Semites, and anarchists? I think it was those three things.
Islamists, fascists, anarchists.
Islamic fundamentalists. Yeah. One of my favorite aspects, well, there's the obvious question that arises, which is why is it the same thing to oppose the actions of a state and its policy, its state policy? Why is it the same thing in any way as to despise an ethnicity of people? I mean, it's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. But the other thing that stands out for me is that the idea that somehow anti-Semitism and anarchism go together. I like that. That has come up a lot in the last little while. And I find it really amazing for a number of reasons. One of those is simply that if you look at the history of anarchism, it's a huge component of the history of Jewish history. There have been countless Jewish anarchists, thinkers, and activists. And in fact, I just happened to come across the other day something that said that the founder of the Canadian Jewish Congress was an anarchist and actually had Emma Goldman come and speak in his home on a regular basis. So that's one sort of like interesting aside. And another is that anarchists and socialists and other kinds of idealists who believe in some kind of, you know, universal social justice, who you know, have a vision that's based on peace and freedom and justice for all people, whatever else you think about anarchism or socialism or any of those sorts of things, there's nothing inherently racist in any way about these principles. And in fact, it's often people from these traditions who are the strongest anti-racists, who are the most vocal in the face of the oppression of any minority or any oppressed group. Quite frankly, in Germany, it was anarchists and socialists, Jews and non-Jews, who died alongside Jews and gypsies and homosexuals in concentration camps. Because they resisted Nazi oppression and they resisted the racism of the Nazi regime. And I think that that's really significant, and I think that that's something we have to think about, that so many of the people who are being persecuted right now are being called anti-Semites, who are being silenced in that way, are actually the people who are the most vocally opposed to any kind of oppression, who are social justice activists, who are confronting the occupation as a racist and violent thing and are opposing it on that level, and, you know, also worked against apartheid in South Africa, against the occupation of East Timor, who you know, work against continued process of colonization in Canada against Indigenous people. I mean, the idea that these are the people that are turned into our enemy, when people like Netanyahu are supposed to be our friend, or George Bush are supposed to be our friend, and are supposed to be the people who we turn to to save us from the possibility of oppression of a Jew, of a minority, of an ethnic minority, is ridiculous. And we need to, I think that the Jewish community really needs to recognize that these are our friends and that we need to be struggling with them against racism. Thanks.